From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, the U.S. strategy for building Syrian opposition, more sanctions on Russia over Ukraine, plus today's U.N. Security Council election. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. British Prime Minister David Cameron, who took part in a video conference with other European leaders and President Obama, said Wednesday, the Ebola outbreak is the worst global health emergency in years. He says the international community needs to do more and do it quickly. His views were echoed by the UN Security Council, which said in a unanimous statement Wednesday, the global community must accelerate and dramatically expand aid to the West African countries battling the epidemic. World Health Organization Wednesday revised the number of deaths and cases of Ebola upward. Nearly 4,500 people in seven countries have died of the deadly virus since March, while close to 9,000 cases have been confirmed. The majority of the cases remain in three West African countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, where the WHO says the situation continues to deteriorate. Tarek Yadarejic is a WHO spokesman.
The number of cases doubles every 4 weeks. So if we do not step up the response, if we let it go as it goes now, we could have anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 cases per week in December. So this is something we do not want to see.
Liberia remains the hardest hit nation with more than 2,500 fatalities, but the UN Health Agency believes the number of cases in the capital, Monrovia, remains significantly underreported. The WHO says while the number of cases in Guinea appears to be falling, in Sierra Leone, transmission of the disease remains rampant, with the capital Freetown and two neighboring western districts the hardest hit. Authorities there have launched a massive awareness campaign, but many families still harbor sick people in their homes and bury the dead without assistance. They refuse to call the Ebola response line, 117, and police official Mustafa Lahai Wednesday took part in one of the outreaches to the Western Freetown community of Aberdeen.
So the only thing people need to do is to put in place some preventive mechanism. So if you see us all out here, it is as a result of trying to take measures that will help us increase, one, the level of awareness and level of cooperation, coordination and collaboration, so that those suspected cases of Ebola can be spotted, can be traced, and reduce the level of transmission.
Ghanaian President Alpha Conde's government has issued a call for retired doctors to return to work to help the country's overstretched health system. The government says 76 doctors have become infected with Ebola and 37 of them have died. A second, smaller Ebola outbreak has been going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo since July, with 69 known cases and 49 deaths. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine conducted by the WHO, Canada, and France shows the virus has a different source in the DRC. The study determined the virus is close to the Zaire strain that caused previous outbreaks. Ebola was first detected in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1976. On Wednesday, news emerged that another U.S. healthcare worker had become infected with Ebola after she took care of a patient who died of the virus. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced the nurse recently flew on a commercial plane. Protocol regarding travel of medical personnel and others is a hot issue right now. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti reports on the scope of restrictions when it involves a highly contagious disease.
29-year-old Amber Vinson is the second healthcare worker in the U.S. to be diagnosed with Ebola. The Centers for Disease Control calls her case very concerning. Vinson treated Ebola patient Thomas Duncan at a Dallas, Texas hospital. He later died of the virus. Because she had close contact with him, Vinson was under self-monitoring for the virus. On Monday, she boarded a plane in Cleveland, Ohio, and flew to Dallas. Prior to the flight, she noted a slightly elevated temperature, but far from the Ebola fever threshold. The next day, she was diagnosed with Ebola. CDC Director Tom Frieden says she should not have been allowed to travel on a commercial plane.
The CDC guidance outlines the need for what is called controlled movement. That can include a charter plane, a car, but it does not include public transport. We will, from this moment forward, ensure that no other individual who is being monitored for exposure undergoes travel in any way other than controlled movement.
President Obama held an emergency meeting with his cabinet to calm American fears.
The likelihood of widespread Ebola outbreaks in this country are very, very low.
50 other healthcare workers who entered Duncan's hospital room are under observation and have been ordered not to travel. The CDC issues those restrictions depending on the level of exposure, high risk, some risk, or no known exposure. State and local officials are responsible for carrying out the CDC guidelines, but the Texas Department of Health told VOA it's still evaluating how to handle enforcement. The CDC says healthcare workers at the Dallas hospital used protective gear, but not according to CDC protocol. They were being overprotective, using multiple layers and sometimes taping it on, which actually puts them at more risk of contamination. The agency is now looking at other team members who currently have no symptoms, leading to this ominous warning from Director Frieden.
We are planning for the possibility of additional cases in the coming days.
Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Matthews-Burwell.
We know how to stop this. We've seen this disease since it was first discovered in the 1970s, and we have seen it stopped. We do know what protocols to use and how they work.
The task now is to get all the protocols in place and enforced. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
European Union health ministers meet in Brussels later today. They'll be discussing their response to the Ebola epidemic. Wednesday, the EU suggested member states provide medical information to West Africa airline passengers, but stopped short of a continent-wide screening of arrivees. Four more U.S. airports today are to enhance screening measures of people arriving from West Africa. France has announced new measures similar to those already in place in Britain and Canada. Doctors Without Borders, also known by the French acronym MSF, said Wednesday it is stretched thin in its effort to help end Ebola. MSF has been at the forefront of fighting the disease in West Africa. Brice Lavigne, director of the operations for MSF, spoke with reporters on Wednesday.
For MSF, it's quite clear that we are reaching our limit. We have been saying that very clearly, that we have reached our limit in terms of increasing. That's why what we're still a bit astonished is the very slow and weak capacity of other actors, including state actors, including multilateral organization actors like WHO, like United Nations, and so on. I mean, they are deploying as we speak, but we still don't see the result in the field.
De La Vigne coordinates missions for MSF and oversees a facility in Brussels that trains volunteers heading for the affected areas. It's the only such training center in Europe, although others operated by different organizations are set to open in Geneva and Berlin. At the Brussels Training Center, a group of trainees who being taught on Wednesday how to enter an Ebola field hospital and how to leave without infecting themselves. Paul Brockman is a project coordinator trainee who will be traveling to Sierra Leone after his training.
We limit the number of times that we suit up and go into the actual high-risk zone where the patients themselves are to just a couple times a day so as not to, as you said, not to risk overheating, dehydration, or just a little bit too much for one day. You know, you need to err on the side of caution rather than the side of full speed ahead.
Spanish psychologist Carla Uriarte, who is likely to leave for Sierra Leone in November, said Wednesday she feels relatively sure she'll be safe.
I'm a bit scared of what I will be seeing, because I know that there's a lot of human suffering that I will be witnessing. And I'm also scared for our staff, because my colleagues will be going back to homes in which their family members might be dying. And I know that some of our colleagues, national staff colleagues, die. And not necessarily, and we do investigate this because they get infected in the center, but because they're part of the community. So that is the part that scares me the most, no? Seeing for them, for their safety.
MSF currently operates six centers in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia with a total of 600 beds. Its personnel on the ground have grown from 650 at the start of August to about 3,000 currently. In Guinea, opposition parties are accusing the government of President Alpha Condé of playing politics with the Ebola outbreak as an excuse to delay municipal elections slated at the end of the year and also a presidential ballot in 2015. But as Karine Kamara reports from Conakry, many believe it would be impossible to organize voting with a health emergency of this magnitude.
The Ebola outbreak is impacting every part of life here in Guinea, restricting personal interactions, slowing commerce, and exhausting the healthcare system. But the political opposition says that is no reason to postpone elections in the coming month. This despite World Health Organization predictions that the number of new cases will spike up to 10,000 per week by December in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the hardest hit nations. Dansa Kuruma, chairman of the Guinean Civil Society Movement, says he thinks the government has no other choice but to delay voting in local elections this year and possibly presidential vote in 2015. He says Ebola is truly a serious public health threat in Guinea, and even though civil society members will never support a delay in elections, Ebola poses a unique challenge that will make voting impossible. He says all elements of society must do their part to contain Ebola, and politicians should not be playing politics. But the opposition is contending that the government will use the delay in order to rig an eventual election or to capitalize on its fight against Ebola to woo voters. Guinea only returned to civilian rule 4 years ago following a 2008 coup. The country held its first election in 2010, voting in Alpha Condé as a president in what international observers deemed a valid ballot. Parliamentary elections were held in September 2013 after repeated delays. The Guinean Electoral Commission has come under severe criticism in the wake of the postponement of this year's vote. The opposition is accusing the commission of bias in favor of the ruling RPG Rainbow Coalition Party and is planning to introduce a bill in parliament to restructure the commission. Liberia has also cancelled the National Senate election last week due to the Ebola epidemic. President Condé has stressed he's solely focusing on containing the Ebola outbreak, the worst in the history and which started in Guinea in December. Guinea has diagnosed more than 1,100 cases with more than 620 people dying from this virus. Health experts say the number are likely to be vastly higher than what officials have been able to record, given the scarcity of medical resources. There is no cure for Ebola, but early diagnosis and medical care can improve chances of survival. Currently, this Ebola outbreak has a mortality rate of 70%. Guinea's government is now calling on all retired doctors to come join the fight. Skilled medical personnel are one of the most critical needs in West Africa's battle against the virus. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
You can stay on top of what's happening with the Ebola outbreak at our website, voanews.com. Look for our special reporting on the homepage.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
U.S. Special Envoy General John Allen says it will take time to train and equip Syria's moderate opposition to fight Islamic State militants because several factors have to be considered. He commented following a trip to the Middle East where he held talks with U.S. allies on building the U.S.-led coalition that's fighting the militants. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
General Allen says one of the coalition's goals is to build up elements of the Free Syrian Army so that over time the group will be able to make its weight felt in the battle against the Islamic State.
It's a holistic approach.
He says there is more to the strategy than just increasing the battlefield capacity of the moderate Syrian opposition.
They need to begin to build and work together to create a coherent political superstructure within which they will ultimately have a political role to play in the outcome of our strategy overall with regard to Syria.
Allen met with the moderate Syrian opposition during his visit to the region. His trip included a stop in Turkey, a nation that has been criticized for its perceived slow response to the crisis, especially in Kobani, a Kurdish town near Syria's border with Turkey. Allen says the coalition has picked up the tempo and intensity of airstrikes around Kobani to push back Islamic State militants.
We're striking the targets around Kobani for humanitarian purposes. I'd be very reluctant to attempt to assign a term like a strategic target or a strategic outcome for the strategy. Clearly, there was a need, given the circumstances associated with the defense of that town.
In an interview with VOA's Kurdish service, Kurdish People's Protection Unit spokesman Polat Kan says his group's forces were assisting coalition efforts to defend Kobani. He said the group has a direct relationship with the coalition in terms of intelligence on a military level and in terms of airstrikes. He also said his group's units in Kobani have been transmitting coordinates to coalition forces for strikes. Meanwhile, General Allen says U.S. coalition building efforts are continuing. He says he will travel to the Gulf region in the coming weeks on a mission to discuss ways to cut off funding to the Islamic State. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
UN General Assembly will elect five new members to the Security Council today, each for a two-year term. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the UN in New York.
The outcome is mostly predetermined before the ballots are cast. Regional groups decide which country to put up as their candidate, eliminating competition. This year, the African group has chosen Angola. The Latin American and Caribbean states have picked Venezuela, and Asia and the Pacific Islanders have put forward Malaysia. As long as these three candidates earn two-thirds of the voting country's ballots, they will join the council on January 1st. The only question mark over the outcome is in the group known as Western Europe and Others. WEOG, as it is known, is not a strictly regional group as it includes far-flung members such as Britain, Canada, Australia, and Israel. In that bloc, Turkey, Spain, and New Zealand are contesting only two available council seats. The winners will replace outgoing members Argentina, Australia, Luxembourg, South Korea, and Rwanda. Karen Ross, executive editor of Independent Diplomat and a past member of Britain's UN delegation, says getting elected to the UN's most powerful body is very much about a country's individual relations with other states and whether a candidate can get them to commit their vote.
This election is often seen rather simplistically as a kind of beauty contest for the popularity of particular countries, but actually under the surface, a lot of how it's determined is a lot to do with vote swapping between countries. You vote for me on this, I'll vote for your judge on the ICJ or other international bodies. There's a lot of that going on.
Ross observes that once on the Security Council, states usually keep their own national interests in mind when negotiating and casting votes.
But I hope it's different. You know, the council really works when diplomats think carefully about the needs of the situation on the ground and don't follow their ideological prejudices.
Of the 10 non-permanent council members, Ross says he knows it sounds cynical, but his experience showed him it is difficult to make a real difference.
Because the reality is there's five countries that matter in the Security Council and not one of them is elected. It's the permanent five. They decide what goes in and out of the council, what decisions it makes about more or less everything.
Whichever five countries succeed in their quest for Security Council seats, there will be no shortage of problems awaiting their attention. The Council oversees matters of international peace and security and has been grappling with an unprecedented number of crises recently in Africa, the Middle East, Ukraine, and the global response to the Ebola virus. New Council members will join the permanent five members, China, France, Russia, Britain, and the United States, and five other non-permanent members, Chad, Chile, Jordan, Lithuania, and Nigeria. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says tensions between Moscow and Washington over the Ukraine crisis threaten strategic stability and that his country will not be blackmailed by Western sanctions. Ties between Russia and the U.S. plummeted earlier this year to a post-Cold War low over Kremlin support for a pro-Russian separatist rebellion in eastern Ukraine and Moscow's annexation of Crimea. Russia has consistently denied the presence of its troops inside Ukraine, while separatist rebel leaders say they have been helped by Russian soldiers. Meantime, Norway, not a member of the EU, is the latest country to impose sanctions on Russia because of what's happening in Ukraine. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshna looks at whether these sanctions on Moscow are working.
The United States and the European Union have imposed several rounds of sanctions against Russia for its annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in March and support of pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Anders Aslund, a Russia expert with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says the first round of sanctions targeted people and enterprises either directly involved in Crimea's annexation or close to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And since July, these sanctions have gone much further, dealing with whole sectors of the Russian economy, notably finance, high-tech, the energy sector and the defense sector.
Many experts, including Matthew Rajansky with the Washington-based Wilson Center, are now asking whether sanctions have worked.
Well, it depends on what your understanding of the purpose of sanctions is. My understanding is that it's mostly intended to change behavior, to deter bad behavior. And in that sense, probably not. Probably it hasn't worked.
Aslund agrees, saying normally sanctions do have an economic effect, but they do not necessarily have the desired political effect. He says the Russian economy is likely to be stagnant this year and probably will gradually decline in the next few years.
The big problem Russia has, its big vulnerability, is that Russia has foreign indebtedness of $730 billion, which is a lot of money. That is about 40% of its current gross domestic product, and it needs to refinance this to the tune of $160 billion a year, and this money is not available now.
Other problems facing the Russian economy include a 20% drop in the price of oil over the past few months. Oil accounts for 50% of Russia's exports. And the value of the Russian currency, the ruble, has dropped by 20% since the beginning of this year. Stephen Jones, a Russia expert at Mount Holyoke College, says Russia's economic woes are not necessarily due to international sanctions.
The Russian economic problems are due to other structural issues that the Russian economy has been facing for years, in particular Russia's dependence on high oil prices, which aren't so high now, and corruption, and the lack of any economic strategy that one can see in Russia that would modernize the economy. If Russia doesn't deal with those issues, it doesn't really matter what about sanctions.
In an effort to retaliate against Western sanctions, Moscow has placed restrictions of its own, such as banning imports of fish, meat, fruits, dairy products, and vegetables from those countries sanctioning Russia. Anders Aslund says when it comes to banning food imports, Moscow is essentially punishing itself.
And if you allow less food imports, as Russia now does, it means many bad things. You get a lot of black trade. It goes mainly through Belarus now. You get a shortage or less supply of food in various parts of the country, and you get higher prices and worse quality. The Kremlin is really hurting the Russian population.
In the final analysis, many experts say sanctions hurt not only the targeted country, but those who impose the punitive measures as well. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Well, how about those global oil prices? They're on their way down amid oversupply and weaker economic activity in Europe and China. Washington Post newspaper says prices have fallen 23% since June. Brent and U.S. crude futures fell Wednesday, a day after posting their biggest daily drop in years. The Brent lost 0.4% to $84.35 a barrel, while U.S. crude fell 0.7% to $81.26. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Sidrak Franklin, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On October 16th, 1701, a charter was granted for a school in New Haven, Connecticut, to preserve the tradition of European liberal education in the New World. The school was renamed Yale College in 1718. Today, Yale is considered one of the nation's best universities. In 1781, at the end of the American Revolution, George Washington captured Yorktown, Virginia. After an attack by French and American forces just days earlier, British forces fled the city. The next day, they began talks on their surrender. On this date in 1793, Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France and Archduchess of Austria, was executed at the height of the French Revolution, 9 months after her husband, King Louis XVI, was beheaded. In 1846, William T.G. Morton demonstrated the use of ether as an anesthesia at the Massachusetts General Hospital. In 1859, on this day, radical abolitionist John Brown, along with a small band of supporters, seized the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. A hoped-for uprising by area slaves never materialized. Brown was captured by U.S. Marines, convicted of treason, and executed. On this day in 1934, Chinese communist leader Mao Zedong broke through nationalist lines and began an epic flight from southwest China known as the Long March. The retreat to the west and north lasted for more than a year. Tens of thousands of Mao's followers died along the way. In 1964, the People's Republic of China joined the nuclear club after a successful test of an atomic bomb. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of the Central African Republic, international peacekeepers and aid workers, continue to come under attack by armed groups there, a nation roiled by almost 2 years of violence that has displaced over 1 million people and killed as many as 5,000. 100,000 migrants from neighboring nations have been forced out of the country by the violence. Since the renewed fighting October 5th, at least a dozen civilians have been killed. A Polish Catholic missionary has been kidnapped near the border with Cameroon. Six United Nations peacekeepers from that country and Burundi were wounded in an ambush over the same violent weekend. The attack follows the killing of the first UN peacekeeper in the CAR, a Pakistani national, and the wounding of others from Pakistan and Bangladesh. This violence must stop immediately. We reiterate our strong support for the efforts of transitional President Samba Panza to bring an end to violence and restore stability to her country. All leaders, including those of armed groups, must work together with the government to advance the political transition process and the national dialogue, which was agreed to in the July 23rd Brazzaville agreements. Violence and calls for a change of government must stop. All Central Africans must come together now to tackle the hard work of national reconciliation, leading to a peaceful political transition and democratic elections. We condemn those political spoilers and human rights abusers who foment and commit violence. Such individuals have no place in the political future of the CAR or in positions of trust. We call for a thorough and transparent investigation of all incidents of violence against civilians. Perpetrators must be held accountable. We stand with the people and leaders of the CAR as they seek to end the violence and bring peace, stability, and security to their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.